So welcome. So for many years, I've been teaching an intro to mindfulness practice. And I started in 1990, when I first started, in 91 perhaps, the first intro class in Palo Alto. And I had never taken an intro to meditation class when I gave one. And I'd been introduced to Vipassana meditation in Southeast Asia, and they didn't do intro classes there. They just, you know, in about 20 minutes told you what the practice was and then sent you to do it for 8 months in a room or something. And you kind of learned more as you went along. But the idea of a gradual class over 5 weeks, as I did it, was something that was, I'd never experienced. But when I started teaching here in California, my colleagues, Jack Kornfield, who was training me, they had already had institutionalized a system of offering a 6-week introductory course. So I figured, well, I'm supposed to be a teacher, I should do that too. But I'd never taken one of those courses. And I thought 6 weeks was way too long, so I made it 5 weeks. And then I made it up. And I found out some years later that my other friends and colleagues, they made it up differently. But I made it up my way. And so some of you have gone to my intro class, and I enjoy doing it a lot. My enjoyment in doing intro class keeps growing the longer I do it, and I look forward to doing it. And I was a little bit reluctant to only do it twice this year, but I wanted to also be able to teach other things. I wanted to teach other kind of introductory classes, kind of in the same spirit, in the same way in which I do the intro to meditation class. And that's what I thought of this class, Introduction to the Fundamentals of Buddhist Life, Buddhist Spiritual Life. And it's meant kind of as a real basic class, a beginner's kind of class. Some of you, I wonder why you're here. But that is as it is. But it's really meant as a basic introductory class. I've never taken a class, Introduction to the Fundamentals of Buddhist Spiritual Life. And as far as I know, none of my colleagues have ever taught this kind of class. So it's something new for me to teach. And as I thought about it, I thought of a lot of different ways to approach the fundamentals of Buddhism, the foundations of Buddhist practice. And sometimes my mind would just go in all directions, and I said, well, I have to teach this, and then that, and this, and that, and that. And then we have a 2-year class just to get through the fundamentals. But one of the beautiful things about the Dharma is that the different elements of Dharma practice, the spiritual life, overlap, interrelate, contain each other, so that you could actually just pick up one element and many of the others would follow in its wake or follow in it. And some people have pointed out that just practicing ethics, the precepts, is a very powerful practice and brings along with it all kinds of wonderful qualities and develops spiritual life just in focusing on ethics. It could be argued that just doing mindfulness practice is all you need to do and everything else will follow. I think that in order for mindfulness is very powerful. And I believe everything you need will mostly follow along if you're very diligent and careful with your mindfulness practice. But there's much more to a Buddhist life than just being mindful. And sometimes I feel a little bit sad when I get the impression from some of the people that I teach that all they're allowed to do in their spiritual life is be mindful. Non-reactive awareness of what's happening in the present moment. And any spiritual life is much broader than just presence, non-reactive awareness. And in the Buddhist tradition, there's many factors which are considered to be supportive of mindfulness practice. And so you get these foundations in place first before you do mindfulness practice. A friend of mine many years ago, a woman from Taiwan, who had come to America as an adult, was raised as a Buddhist, and was studying doctoral studies of Buddhist studies at Stanford. And she was quite serious about Buddhist practice. She had a Buddhist teacher and devoting her life to it. And I asked her if she meditated. And I assumed that pretty much anybody who was serious about Buddhism would meditate. And her answer surprised me. And she said, no, not yet. I'm working on myself so that I'm worthy enough to meditate. Isn't that something? So she had kind of the classic kind of Asian idea of Buddhism, that you don't just kind of put yourself into meditation cold, but you actually prepare yourself for that. And by doing other things first and creating a really good foundation for meditation. So some of the other elements of Buddhism are the supports for mindfulness practice itself that make it go, makes it go, become stronger, mature better in a healthier and a safer way. But a spiritual life, in the Buddhist terms, is much more than just being mindful. It involves a whole orientation of how we live in the world. And that orientation then informs Buddhists in all their choices and how they live their lives. The choices of including things like how what kind of work they do, how they, you know, their activities in the world and their purchases perhaps, what they buy and what they don't buy, and how they relate to neighbors and community and to nature around them. And there's all a tremendous amount of, you know, Buddhist life is not just meditation. It's about how we live our life. And I would suggest that since the title of this is A Buddhist Life, many people are trying to look at how to put some Buddhism into their life. How to, you know, sprinkle some mindfulness practice, or sprinkle some good things in Buddhism to improve their life and all that. And that's fine. And I'm very happy to offer Buddhist practice as a spicing in people's lives or the little medicine in their lives that helps them. But, you know, it's kind of like adapting Buddhism for your life. And there's a whole other approach, which is to adapt your life to Buddhism and to live a Buddhist life. And that's possible to do that. And some people will do it to greater and lesser degrees. And I'm not here to tell you what you should be doing, or I don't really have any expectation of what you're supposed to be doing. But I thought it'd be nice to offer this kind of class and give you at least my take on what I think is the foundations. And then you can pick up and do with that what you'd like. And since you showed up, it's a self-selecting audience, right? I don't have to worry about trying to, you know, I'm not propagating here or anything. I'm just talking to people who seem to want to come to this. So, so what we'll do in these 5 weeks is, much like the way we do for the intro to meditation class, mindfulness class, is go through elements of Buddhist practice which build on each other, support each other. And just like in the intro in mindfulness class, if you get a good sense of how to work with the breath, it's easier to work with the body. If you have a good sense of how to work with the body, it's easier to work with emotions. If you have a good sense of how to work with emotions, it's easier to work with your mental life and thoughts. And if you have a good sense of how to work with your thoughts and mental life, it's a lot easier to apply the practice in your daily life. So in the same way, this class is built on things that build on each other. So today I'm going to talk about the basic ideas of the orientation of a Buddhist life and the intention, the idea of orientation and intention. And then that'll be a support for next week when we talk about some of the, what can in shorthand be called some of the ethical issues of Buddhism, but I prefer to call them the relational. That aspect of our life where we try to live wisely in relationship to others. And that has to do with ethics, and it has to do with generosity. The third week will build on that, and it'll be a little bit more of that relational aspect of life. And this will be the aspects of love, the Buddhist take on love, which it has to do also with relationship with others and the world around us. And the following week we'll talk about the idea of what's called in Buddhism cultivation. Developing oneself. That a Buddhist life is one that's concerned with developing oneself in various ways, developing one's mind, one's heart. And then the final week, we'll talk about, after we talk about developing, we'll talk about letting go. And letting go is also a very important part of the path. And letting go is that which ultimately will lead to the fruition of the Buddhist life, which is liberation. There are many different models or ideas of what a spiritual path is about. You find many of them just in Buddhism itself. And sometimes people are at odds with each other, which path is better, which one is the highest truth, and which one is false or whatever. I'm actually not so interested in comparing that way different paths. I think they all, I kind of take it as a tenet that all paths, all kind of ways of practicing, are valid for different people at different times. And so they all point to something that's very important. And I'm actually more interested in how they all can be seen as being in harmony with each other rather than how they can be opposed to each other. So if you come with your own notions and ideas of a spiritual life and a path from some other tradition or other Buddhist tradition or your own inclinations, you might carry that with you as a principle you might explore during these weeks. Is rather than being in opposition to what I'm saying, see if you can find some way to incorporate it, to assimilate it, or use it to support maybe the way you understand things or how you'd like to understand things. The particular idea of a Buddhist life or spiritual life by the Buddha could be understood as being a developmental model of the path, or developmental model of life, that is very much in harmony with or in goes along with the idea of human development, in a rough sense. In the sense that you look at a child and how a child grows up. Many of us are concerned with how children grow, and we teach them. We teach them academics. We teach them values. We teach them all kinds of things. And as the children grow, as they, both because of the way they're taught and because of the environment and because of internal things, biological things that the child has themselves, they develop, they grow. And you can see stages of children developing over time. And it would be foolish to not notice and be wise about the development of children over time and somehow incorporate that into our relationship to children and support the development of children over time and how they develop. So when a person becomes an adult in a normal, healthy environment, that's kind of when the Buddhist path would begin. And then that developmental trajectory continues. It's just a normal, kind of almost biological thing that happens, just like biologically whatever children develop over time. And so once we become an adult, we're not fixed beings anymore. We become a fixed thing. But we're still capable of continued development. And I would suggest that in a healthy environment, that that probably we would all develop quite beautifully through our adult years. And so, and probably some of you can recognize changes in yourself in your adult years. Things that values you had or concerns you had or difficulties you had earlier in life as an adult are no longer here now. You see things differently because of the stage of life you're in. So the Buddha saw the spiritual life in developmental terms and that things can change and cultivate and develop with time. And that development has certain patterns, certain laws, that the Buddha would say are universal. And so he would then lay down the spiritual life as a path of gradual cultivation and development. What that implies is that Buddhists are phenomenally patient. Buddhists are not into instant gratification, but rather kind of like good adults. They think that if you want something, it takes a while to get it. It takes a while to develop certain skills, develop certain qualities, understandings, and that just like if you want to go and develop your body by going to a local gym, you don't expect to go to the gym and lift up a couple of barbells and then go home and that's it, instant enlightenment and instant strength and that's it. But it takes a while to develop yourself, and you need to have certain attitudes and approaches and discipline to developing your body by going to the gym. You need to have consistency. Of wise approach to what you do, of patience, a whole bunch of attitudes that are needed to have if you're not going to suffer while you do it. So the same thing in doing a Buddhist spiritual life. It takes a wise attitude, a wise understanding, it takes patience, and it takes a sense that we're actually kind of, that there's a goal or a direction, directionality in that development. Now, the Buddha said that the Dharma is good in the beginning, good in the middle, and good in the end. And he said that a lot. And how I understand that is that Dharma practice, the Dharma life, is meant to be good at its inception. It's meant to be good in the middle of doing it, And it's meant to be good at the fruition of it, the end of it. That is supposed to be a good thing. It's supposed to be a beneficial thing. And it's meant to be something that that brings happiness. Happiness is one of the keys to the Buddha's spiritual life. It's about developing happiness of different kinds. It's about understanding the natures of happiness, understanding how to develop it, understanding how to support it, and understanding how it can be a healthy goal for our lives to develop our capacity to be happy. Happiness is a really important part of what we're going to talk about in these 5 weeks. And hopefully, as we talk about these different elements of the fundamentals, either through what I say, hopefully, or through your own understanding, you will be able to connect these different elements to how these things support your capacity to be happy. And that you'll hopefully, after 5 weeks, become a happier person. That would be great, wouldn't it? It'd make me very happy. And maybe it'll just be little increments. You know, we don't do instant gratification here. But that's kind of like the name of the game. You're not supposed to become a grim Buddhist, you know, or, you know, and bear down or go around kind of, you know, with a flag of suffering and say, I'm a Buddhist, I look at suffering and life is suffering and, you know, and isn't it terrible? You're not supposed to be really serious about your Buddhism. One of the things that kills the Buddhist spiritual life is excessive seriousness. So I remember once telling my Zen teacher, you know, I'm not very serious about this Zen practice. I was living in the monastery. I'm not so serious about this Zen practice, but it's what I'm most serious about in my life. You know, it can be, for someone who wants to really adopt a life of practice, it can have greater priority than just about anything else. But even in that case, don't be too serious about it. Don't so serious that it weighs you down. It's supposed to be good. It's supposed to bring happiness, delight. It's supposed to gladden the heart. So you want to kind of take that approach as you explore all this. Another element that I want to point out as an introduction is that it's useful to think of the Buddhist spiritual life or the Buddhist development as a pyramid, as a three-sided pyramid. And the importance of having a pyramid as a model for the path is a pyramid has a wide, stable base. And it's a little bit hard to tip over, push over a pyramid because of that solid base. And so what's at the top of the pyramid is supported by the whole, you know, pyramid below it. And so if you want to build a stable pyramid, you first kind of lay the strong, broad foundation, base. And then you build something that's almost as wide above that, and then something that's almost as wide above that, until finally you get really high and you get this little point at the very top. If you just had point was to get to the top point really quickly, or and you had a very straight and narrow path that didn't create the foundation, you'd have like a stick like this, standing up like this, and then it would just fall over. And it just, you know, falls over all the time. And I know lots of people who've taken that kind of fast route in Buddhist practice. They've kind of dived into to practice or be engaged in or experienced some of the, I guess I should say the highest, I was going to say deepest, the highest, to be consistent with the metaphor, the highest aspects of Buddhist practice. And they've, you know, it's been quite rewarding in some ways, but their lives have been like this as a result. And sometimes frightfully so, very difficult for them to come back from that kind of peak experience because they haven't integrated the rest of their life. They haven't created that broad foundation. And it's a much healthier for people to create this broad foundation first for the highest practice and the highest realization. So you want to be a little bit careful with teachers who want to give you the highest teaching right away. Like myself, you can come into my 5-week intro in mindfulness class. It turns out that mindfulness is considered one of the highest teachings. So be a little bit leery of people like me. And there's a Burmese teacher up in Sebastopol. Her name is Dr. Tintin. And she once told me that, in Burma, people are not taught mindfulness off the street like they are in America. Mindfulness is the cream. Vipassana is kind of like the top of the pyramid. And you would first do a lot of other work first preparing you for that higher point. You know, in Tibetan practice, they have nundro, which you spend all this preparation practice. You do 100,000 prostrations and 100,000 mantras and 100,000 making a little Buddha statues and I don't know what the other things, 100,000 offerings. And that's a lot of things to do. And that's kind of the preparation of body, mind, and speech to get you to a point where you're ready psychically and physically to receive higher and deeper teachings. It's capable of giving people higher and deeper teachings, but it's not so useful unless they have that good wide base. So I said the triangle is a three-sided triangle because the three sides are body, speech, and mind. And so every layer, as you go up the pyramid, has a physical aspect, a bodily aspect, it has a vocal aspect, and it has a heart aspect or mind aspect. Heart and mind are the same, so body, speech, and heart, or body, speech, and mind, whatever you prefer. And so it's very important to understand that it has those three aspects. Because again, sometimes people who engage in Buddhist practice tend to focus on one more than the other. And most commonly, they tend to focus on the mind or the heart, the inner life, as if it's all about changing something on the inside, changing your mind or developing some kind of having some kind of great mental experience of bliss or oneness or whatever people think, or about changing the mind in some way. It's all a mental kind of thing. And Buddhist practice is not meant to be just a mental thing. It's meant to be totally integrated and with our full humanity. And the way that's said in the tradition is practice involves body, speech, and mind. So three sides of the pyramid. And so each layer has those three sides. So we look at how it affects our speech, how it affects our behavior, and also how it affects our heart, so how it relates to the heart and the mind. So I'd like us to do a short meditation in a few minutes. But as an introduction to it, I'd like to give another piece having to do with the heart or the mind, but it also applies to the body and speech. And that is all aspects of our psychophysical being is understood in Buddhism to be relatively malleable if it's developed, if it's cultivated. What a human being is a process and not a thing. If you want to try to find your true self, which some people like to use that kind of language, Buddhists would say you won't find a thing as your true self. You'll find a process. You find an activity that's in movement, in flux, changing. And because the human being is a series of processes, and because they're not fixed processes, it's possible to shape those processes. It's possible to shape the mind because the mind is a process and not a thing. Or the heart is. It's possible to change how we speak because speech is a process and not a fixed thing. It's possible to change our body, our bodily behavior because it's a process and not a thing. And so part of Buddhist practice then is taking some responsibility for these processes of body, speech, and mind and beginning to shape them in ways that are healthy, helpful, and healing. And so how do we shape them? What is healthy? What is healing? What is helpful for us is a big part of what we'll talk about in a little while. But, you know, so for example, if you feel that it's helpful to be kinder, it might not be easy to decide to be kind just like that. But it's possible to cultivate and change the heart, the mind. So that becomes a disposition or inclination of the heart or the mind to respond to situations with greater kindness. And it's possible to develop kindness over time. It's possible to develop generosity. It's possible to develop wisdom and love, mindfulness, concentration. There's a lot of capacities that can be developed. And probably it wouldn't take a lot of reflection on any of your parts, if you were honest about yourself, to recognize ways in which your dispositions, your inclination, the way that you tend to operate in the world, has been shaped by forces outside of you, by things like advertisement or the media or your local environment. I was surprised when I came to Palo Alto in 1990 that I had this old beat up Toyota which I was very happy to have. And then for many years, I was very happy having in Palo Alto. But at some point, after being there in Palo Alto, I think maybe 5 or 6 or so years, I started noticing that I think I had one of the oldest cars in Palo Alto. And there was this kind of thing of kind of, you know, beginning kind of sense that I was different, you know, that all these people, it seems to be like a lot of people in Palo Alto had newish cars. And this feeling, oh, you know, I'm not quite right. It's not quite right for me to have this old car. I'm not quite adequate. And I could feel that this kind of environment, no one was doing anything. No one was saying anything. No one was telling me, Gil, you know, you should think about your car. But, you know, it was just the environment lended itself to kind of influencing the shape of my thoughts and my disposition and kind of what I thought was I needed to have. So the mind, so I use a little story as an example of how the mind can be shaped by the environment and by media, by friends. I've been shaped by some of my friends, hanging out with them. Sometimes not to the best. So when I was younger, I remember hanging out with people who influenced me in ways that I'm a little bit embarrassed to say some of the things, some of the ways that I was. When I had a leather jacket and a motorcycle, and was in a pseudo motorcycle gang. So, I've come a long way. So the idea of shaping and then taking some responsibility for that shaping, but doing it in a way that brings you happiness, doesn't come as a burden or a feeling that you should be different or you better be different or you're inadequate in some terrible way or it's embarrassing that, but rather to do it with a kind of sense of uplift and lightness and joy. Oh yeah, isn't it great that human beings are this way? We have this capacity to develop and I can engage in it and I don't know how long it's going to take to make a change, but at least it's great to know this and to incline the heart in that direction. So taking a stable posture, you might think again of the pyramid as you make your posture. For those people sitting cross-legged, you get, you know, more obviously a sense of a pyramid. But the idea, whatever way you sit, to get a sense of a stable base, perhaps a broad base, feeling the lower part of your body, relaxing your weight downwards, letting your chair or the floor receive you, hold you. Spending some time with your body, feeling your body, becoming familiar with your body, body, speech, and mind, the three kind of locuses of practice. So just now, for now, just become familiar with your body as it is right now. Explore different parts of it. Check it out, how it feels, what's going on in it. My guess is that most of you, as you're sitting here, are having some thoughts going through your mind. For now, we can just provisionally call them, that's the vocal part, the speech part. You're talking to yourself. As you're sitting here, see if you can take a little bit responsibility for what you're thinking about. And think about your body. Stay in your body. Think about your body. And think about your body along terms in kind ways. Or happy ways. See if you can find some thoughts or some ideas, some understandings of your body that bring you a sense of goodwill towards your body, or a sense of happiness or delight about your body. This is not positive thinking. You're not trying to pretend. But can you find some sincere thoughts of goodwill or delight. And then within the body, as part of the body, become aware of your breathing. And if you've had meditation instruction before, forget it. Forget your instructions. And take a few minutes just to become familiar with what it's like to be breathing at this particular time. Feeling your breath. And letting yourself think, don't have to stop your thinking. But see if you can discover in the realm, the world of your thoughts, your understanding, your ideas, if you have any thoughts or can have any thoughts or ideas that involve goodwill towards your breathing, or a sense of happiness or delight concerning your breathing. And then bring your attention more carefully to your breathing. Feel your breathing in your torso, your belly or your chest. Feel the movement there, the expansion and contraction. Feel the rhythm of breathing in and out. And as you exhale, see if you can relax and settle into that broad base. Let the weight of your body sink a little bit as you exhale. The weight of your belly, your torso, relaxing any tension you might be carrying in your torso or your belly, chest. letting the breath wash through you, the in-breaths and out-breaths. Letting it wash through your mind so that every time you exhale, you let go of your thinking, almost as if the breath or the waves washing up and down across the shore. And as the waves go out, leave the shore, as you exhale, it takes away your thoughts, carries them out to the sea. So we're doing something very simple, being present here for our body, our breath, letting our thoughts soften or float away as we breathe out. And is there anything about doing this here and now which gives you some inkling of happiness or delight or joy or satisfaction? Is there some happiness to be found in sitting quietly, being attentive to what is here? And if there is some happiness, can you let that happiness support your attention to the breathing, to be part of it? Is there any sense of well-being to be had that's available as you sit here, quietly being in your body? You might be feeling other things also, discomfort or many things which might be uncomfortable. But even with that, can you find some inkling of well-being? And then as part of this short sitting meditation time, I'd like to ask you some reflective questions, questions for you to think about in your eyes are still quiet, closed. If you'd like to, if you're uncomfortable at all at this point, you're welcome to change your posture so you're more comfortable for the reflection. What is your relationship to happiness? Do you feel like it's okay to be happy? Is it something you'd like to experience? Does happiness appear to you to be a profound goal of life or a superficial goal? Does it seem excessively selfish to pursue happiness? What's your relationship to happiness? Is it a stranger to you? Is being happy a gift for others? Have you ever felt someone else's happiness as a gift to you? What do you know about the healthy and appropriate pursuit of happiness? what stands in the way of your happiness.